Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Why haven't you learned anything?
It looked sort of like a normal school day in Georgia, and that's what makes it all so surprising. There were these pictures of students shuffling to class in crowded hallways, not wearing masks. At another school in Georgia, several students tested positive for the coronavirus. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Ellen Eldridge is in Cherokee County, where schools are open for business, and she joins us now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, good morning.
So just walk us through what happened. Schools opened, then what?
Yeah, well, this week it started out really well. There were a lot of excited students, parents, teachers. The kids, of course, were excited to go back to school and see their friends after being in quarantine. Everybody's doing their best, even though we're living through a pandemic. For the most part, teachers felt pretty anxious. They had little time to prepare. The expectations were high. And I think overall, parents didn't really expect outbreaks and cases to start coming up this first week. But for as much of the negativity, there are still many people who are positive and excited about the first week back to school.
Right. You mentioned teachers. I mean, clearly teachers around the country have been really anxious about getting back in the physical classroom and the risk and the exposure that they themselves might get. Have you been able to talk to any of them?
Yeah, I've spoken to many educators, most of them off the record. They're afraid of retaliation, afraid of losing their jobs. Many teachers have said privately that they feel they're actually being threatened by the administration if they do speak out. And, you know, it's clear that as afraid they are of the virus, they have been provided hand sanitizer. There are custodians in the schools and a plan. One of the teachers I spoke with, she's a former teacher in the district, Miranda Wicker. She's become kind of a de facto voice for the teachers. She said some teachers even had to make the decision to leave, and I spoke to one instructor who resigned before classes even started.
Teachers deeply love their profession, their calling. It's a calling for most of them. It's not something they just do. So to walk away from it takes just a tremendous amount of force to push them into that.
So yeah, the teachers, I mean, they love what they do. They went into this with purpose, but they weren't expecting, you know, a virus, a pandemic. And they've been told so far in Cherokee County that they're not allowed to do any additional safety measures. They're not allowed to even spend their own money to bring in the plastic partitions. So, you know, and most importantly, they were protesting before school even opened. They wanted mask mandates in schools. And
right.
that just hasn't happened.
Right. So tell me more about parents. I mean, I know a lot of parents are very excited if their school district is opening, but it's a different ballgame when you get confirmed cases.
Yeah, and a lot of what I'm hearing, there are a good number of parents who are excited. They, you know, they don't view the schools as babysitters, but they see it as a place of education, social interaction, growth. All those things, of course, are crucial. But the fact is that we just don't know that much about the virus and how it transmits. And, you know, the outbreaks were expected. And yeah. Most parents feel that they, you know, they made the right decision. One parent, Jamie Chambers, he's been very outspoken. He feels more confident in his decision to start with digital learning. So he's happy about that.
It is still so disruptive. I'm expecting to see more of the same. I think entire classrooms will be quarantined. I will be amazed if we make it to Labor Day without an entire district-wide shutdown.
So we'll just have to see about that, right? I mean, school districts are going to have to be nimble. I imagine closures, openings as cases pop up over the school year. Ellen Eldridge of Georgia Public Broadcasting, we appreciate you. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
LA Mayor Eric Garcetti announced yesterday that the city will crack down on large parties that flout orders to socially distance during the pandemic. The punishment for repeat offenders? Well, authorities will now direct the DWP to shut off a property's water and power. The move comes while coronavirus cases in California remain persistently high, and just days after a fatal shooting took place at one of these large parties on Mulholland Drive. Here's Mayor Eric Garcetti.
Some research has shown that 10% of people cause 80% of the spread. These super spreader events and super spreader people have a disproportionate impact on the lives that we are losing. And we cannot let that happen like we saw on Mulholland Drive on Monday night.
This order to crack down on parties comes months into a citywide order to stay at home. It really highlights how officials have struggled to use their powers to enforce that order. KPCC reporter Robert Garova is on this story for us. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, A.
Now, these gatherings are reportedly happening at so-called party houses, and those are usually rental or Airbnb residences that become makeshift nightclubs and can host hundreds of people. Party houses, nothing new in L.A., but what are you hearing from residents now that they're having to deal with pandemic party houses?
Well, the president of the Hollywood Hills West Neighborhood Council told me yesterday that they're proliferating and out of control, and she said it's become worse during the pandemic because the bars are closed. I also talked with Ellen Evans. She's with the Bel Air Beverly Crest Neighborhood Council. Here's what she told me.
It's completely an outrage because anybody who's sitting at home really trying hard not to come in contact with others feels that others should have the same obligation.
The house party where a 35-year-old woman you were talking about earlier was shot and killed was in her area. So people who live in these areas are saying it's more of a problem than ever.
During this pandemic, though, it's not just about the people who live there. It's kind of about all of us and the need to control the spread of the virus. So how are city officials trying to crack down on this?
Well, there are some pre-pandemic ordinances that are in place to try and keep party houses in check. There was an ordinance passed in 2018 that's meant to prohibit loud and unruly gatherings on residential property. That's how the ordinance reads. It imposes thousands of dollars in fines for violations, but members of neighborhood councils in areas that regularly see these wild parties say many wealthy party organizers and homeowners are really undeterred by the fines. District 4 Councilman David Rue introduced a motion yesterday that seeks to have the Department of Building and Safety, Water and Power, and others, you know, kind of come together and figure out what deterrence tools can be used, including utility shutoffs. So then, later that afternoon, Mayor Garcetti had this to say.
Starting on Friday night, if the LAPD responds and verifies that a large gathering is occurring at a property, and we see these properties reoffending time and time again, they will provide notice and initiate the process to request that DWP shut off service within the next 48 hours.
We should note, too, that L.A. County has an existing order that prohibits gatherings during the pandemic, and it applies to the city of L.A. as well.
All right, so a lot of the things that are going on are definitely against the rules. So what's going on with enforcement, though?
So City Attorney Mike Fuhrer's office told me yesterday that if a case is referred to them, they will review it for possible criminal prosecution. Captain Steve Lurie with the LAPD's Hollywood Division told Larry Mantle on Air Talk yesterday that they've seen a 25% increase in complaint calls. When they go out to big parties like these, he said, you know, they can cite and warn people for things like underage drinking and illegal parking. But they're really not in the business of enforcing the health orders that are in place, at least at private residences. You know, so really for now, you know, it seems the city is trying to figure out what it can do to stop the parties with things like utility shutoffs, prosecution after the fact. But, you know, that doesn't do much to break them up in the moment.
All right. That's KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
I've always said, listen, college football is king of the world.
Several Pac-12 football players who threatened to opt out of the 2020 season are still waiting for their concerns to be addressed. The clock is ticking as practice is scheduled to begin in the next few weeks. We learn more from KNKX sports commentator Art Thiel. Art, what's driving this movement?
Well, I think it's the convergence of the racial injustice laid bare by the George Floyd murder and the subsequent protests, and the pandemic. I think what's happening here is the realization that football players are the game. It's not the college. It's not the tradition. It's the players, and it's an empowering moment, and they want some leverage here to address a lot of grievances that have accumulated over time and that many people have known about in college sports. Basically, it's exploitation of them. One of the players said, I don't want to be a lab rat. And that refers to the fact that they're going to try to protect these players as much as possible, but there's been an absence of transparency that they want addressed as part of this package.
Right. Let's talk about some of the specific demands.
Well, there's about four categories that the Pac-12 players presented in a Players Tribune story earlier in the week. And the first one, as I mentioned, is the health and safety protections. They also want to see protection for the existence of other varsity sports at every university. And they want that done by reducing what they call lavish expenditures. And they also want improved emphasis on racial injustice. They want a task force created to address these issues, including an athlete summit annually to address issues unique to black players. And they also want a 2% diversion of athletic revenues in order to fund a pool of money that would help impoverished black students, not just athletes. And then they want economic freedom and unity. Under that category, they want 6 years of insurance coverage after graduation for conditions and injuries related to playing football. Currently, that is 4 years. They want immediate revenues from use of their names, image, and likenesses. That's something that the NCAA is going to do, but maybe not until 2023. This protest might advance that. They also made a request that sounded straight out of pro sports. They want 50% of all the athletic revenues to be paid to not only football players, but all scholarship athletes in all sports. I think that's a noble goal, but that won't happen until college sports is completely professionalized.
So what has the Pac-12's response been so far to all these demands?
Well, they've acknowledged they've received the letter and the information, and they've made a commitment to talk, but they haven't really said anything substantively about how this is going to work.
So what's your feeling about whether any progress can be made toward resolution of some of these issues?
Well, this is a rare point of leverage for athletes in the fight to get fairness in college athletics. And I think they're going to get progress on safety. They've got to. And I think they're going to make progress on the racial justice end of things. The financial stuff is going to have to wait. But if they can get a promise out of the NCAA to address this sort of thing immediately after a football season, should it be played, I think that would be a substantial benchmark in the history of college athletics.
All right, Art, thanks.
My pleasure.
KNKX sports commentator Art Thiel's website is Sports Press Northwest at sportspressnw.com.
White supremacy is the sickness.
At the beginning of the pandemic, a federal civil rights office warned states, doctors, and hospitals, don't place elderly or disabled people at the back of the line for care. Now, several disability groups have asked that federal office to investigate the death of a man with COVID-19 in Texas. They say he was denied treatment because of his significant disabilities. NPR's Joseph Shapiro has the story.
What Melissa Hickson says happened to her husband and what the hospital says are in conflict. Michael Hickson was a quadriplegic. He'd been diagnosed with COVID-19. Now he had pneumonia. On June 5th, Melissa Hickson went to see her husband on the ICU at St. David's South Austin Medical Center in Austin, Texas. A BiPAP machine, a kind of ventilator that people often use in their own homes, was pushing air into his lungs to help him breathe. Through the mask, he answered her questions with short answers.
I said, I want you to say it with me, and I want you to keep it in your mind. I said, you will live and not die. You will live.
Under the mask of the breathing machine, she could see his lips move as he said it. She called the kids on the phone, their five teenage children, for a FaceTime conversation. They told their dad what they were up to. The 16-year-old was excited she was going to get her driver's license.
They chattered, very chattery. And so I can see him just kind of shaking his head like, yeah.
One morning, 3 years ago, Michael Hickson was driving his wife to work when he went into sudden cardiac arrest. Blood stopped flowing to his brain and his organs. The result was a brain injury, blindness, and quadriplegia. In the 3 years since, he'd moved from hospital to nursing home to back home and then back to more hospitals and nursing homes. On that day at the hospital, Hickson found her husband's doctor in the hallway. He told her, we're going to stop treating your husband and move him from the ICU to hospice care. This is from a recording of their conversation.
The decision is Do we want to be extremely aggressive with his care?
The doctor is explaining, do we want to be extremely aggressive with his care, or would it be futile?
As of right now, his quality of life, he doesn't have much of one.
The doctor says her husband doesn't have quality of life, and if we have to intubate him, put him on a more powerful ventilator, in his weakened condition, he's not going to survive. That didn't make sense to Melissa Hickson. Her husband had pneumonia before. Other hospitals had successfully treated it.
This decision was not made based on a disability in any way.
Dr. DeVry Anderson is the chief medical officer at St. David's, the Texas hospital. He said it wasn't a decision to ration health care. He says Michael Hickson was much sicker than his wife may have realized, that he had sepsis, pneumonia in both lungs, that his organs were shutting down, and that it wasn't one doctor who made the decision to end treatment. It was a medical team of doctors, palliative care specialists, and the chaplain. They got sign-off from Michael Hickson's guardian. A Texas probate court had appointed an elder care agency to make medical decisions for Michael Hickson. That happened after Melissa Hickson disagreed with a previous hospital that wanted to discharge her husband to a nursing home. She insisted he needed specialized care at a brain injury center. Dr. Anderson says the doctor who used the term no quality of life, he wasn't talking about Michael Hickson's disabilities.
But rather, he was trying to help Ms. Hickson understand compassion based on understanding what quality of life is, how someone might suffer more based on doing things that we consider to be treatments or interventions that are actually not helping them be better or feel better.
On that tape, Melissa Hickson challenged the doctor. Are you saying because he's paralyzed with a brain injury, he doesn't have quality of life?
Correct.
Correct, the doctor says. Devin Stahl is an associate professor of ethics at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Hospitals call her in on cases just like this. She wasn't consulted on this case, but she's listened to the tape.
It was very troubling, kind of a gut punch.
Kind of a gut punch.
Because a treatment working or not working has nothing to do with a patient's quality of life, however it's deemed by this physician. And by all accounts, by his wife, that he had a quality of life.
Stahl says there's research that we, all of us, including doctors, see someone like Michael Hickson with a significant disability and say, I wouldn't want to live like that. And we have a bias to underestimate what that disabled person would say about their quality of life. Melissa Hickson says no one asked her husband if he wanted treatment.
He would say, I want to live. I love my children and my family. They're the most important things to me. He would probably say that that's the reason for the past 3 years I have fought to survive.
On June 11th, Michael Hickson died, less than a week after the hospital stopped his treatment. Several disability organizations have filed complaints against St. David's Hospital. They've asked the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to investigate. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The United States continues to lead the world in the most confirmed cases of the coronavirus. More than 4.5 million have been infected since the pandemic began. The next country behind the U.S., Brazil, with more than 2.5 million. The six countries following the U.S. are considered middle-income nations. NPR's Jason Beaubien explains why these places were uniquely at risk from the virus.
Outside of the U.S., if you look at the countries with the most coronavirus cases, they have something in common. They're some of the most influential players in the global South. Brazil, India, South Africa, Mexico are not only major emerging market economies, they're regional political powers, and they're all grappling with accelerating COVID outbreaks.
This evening, as I stand here before you, our nation is confronted by the gravest crisis in the history of our democracy.
In mid-July, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa tightened lockdown measures, made wearing masks in public mandatory, and reimposed a ban on the sale of alcohol.
The coronavirus storm is far fiercer and much more destructive than any that we have known before. It is stretching our resources as we speak, but it is also stretching our resolve to their very limits.
South Africa has now reported nearly 500,000 cases of COVID-19. South Africa's borders remain closed, and the pandemic has pushed the country's official unemployment rate above 30%.
When the coronavirus first struck South Africa, it was a model for its early response to the pandemic. The country locked down right away, hired thousands of health workers, and flattened the curve. But now, South Africa is reporting 500,000 cases of COVID-19, becoming the country with the fifth largest caseload in the world. NPR's Ada Peralta reports.
Funerals in South Africa used to take place from Thursday through Sunday. Now, machines are digging graves every day.
The funerals are every day, and then mostly weekends. Saturday, Sunday is too much, so it's bad, really.
That is one of the grave diggers who did not give his name because he's not authorized to speak to the press. Journalist Mathilde Boussio recorded this scene at one of the biggest cemeteries in Johannesburg, where the number of people buried has doubled between June and July. It means 7 days a week, nonstop, family and friends gather to say goodbye. The South African government has argued that with 8,000 dead, its death rate is among the lowest in the world. But in July, the country consistently reported more than 10,000 cases a day. It blew past Italy, the UK, and Mexico in confirmed cases.
I feel like the world is looking at that curve, and they're saying, oh my God, it's another Brazil. It's another US. Is it an unfair comparison to say...
Completely unfair, yeah.
On the phone is Salim Abdul Karim, the top scientist advising the government.
In South Africa, government takes this very seriously.
He says, indeed, the true number of deaths in South Africa is likely double the official number, but it could have been so much worse. Karim argues that despite the fact that South Africa was already in a recession when the pandemic started, it implemented one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. It allowed the government, he says, to build field hospitals and stock up on oxygen and medicine. Even now, at the peak of the country's epidemic, hospitals are not overwhelmed.
I don't want to romanticize that or overstate the level of preparedness because we made a lot of mistakes. But the preparations we did are enabling us to save lives.
One mistake, he says, is that they moved too slowly to start educating South Africans on what they could do to stop the spread.
We didn't move fast enough to transition people from being anxious and scared to feeling like they had the power to control their risk.
Another total lockdown is off the table, so the only way to flatten this curve, he says, is for South Africans to change their behavior. He says he takes hope from the AIDS epidemic. It was when South Africans started seeing their families and neighbors die that they took precautions.
It's now not somebody telling you what to do. It becomes personal. You've now firsthand, you have seen this. You've seen its impact.
During the last few days, cases have started declining. He hopes it's a sign South Africans have begun to take the pandemic personally.
South Africa's borders remain closed, and the pandemic has pushed the country's official unemployment rate above 30%. Middle-income countries are a diverse group and home to 75% of the world's people, according to the World Bank. These are nations where annual per capita income is between $1,000 and $12,000. The U.S., by comparison, is $66,000 per year. Collectively, over the last decade, these countries have lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And Amanda Glassman with the Center for Global Development says these countries have a lot to lose in this pandemic.
They have most of their population in this group that would fall back into poverty given a shock like this one.
The entrepreneurial spirit that made countries like India, Brazil, and South Africa dynamic emerging markets also put them at greater risk of having large outbreaks. These are places with a lot of hustle, as Glassman puts it. Their economies were global. Business travelers and tourists jetted in and out. They have decent domestic transportation networks, offering the coronavirus or other pathogens easy avenues to spread.
I'm just worried that we're setting back the process of economic and social development that has gone so quickly over the past decade, and it will just take us many years to catch back up.
Unlike some extremely poor countries, most of these nations have health systems capable of detecting the disease.
In India, for example, they're doing a lot of testing.
Jonathan Keemer is a risk analyst at World Aware.
In Russia, they're doing a lot of testing. And the more people you test, the more confirmed cases you're going to have.
He says some middle-income countries look worse simply because they're doing far more testing than their neighbors. For instance, Peru has one of the largest outbreaks, but it's also testing at a rate 5 times the global average. The potential for social instability during this crisis is higher in middle-income countries, Keimer says, compared to poor or wealthy nations. People in these countries have recently seen economic gains and now are having their aspirations dashed by government lockdowns.
One of the major things that we look at in these countries is how this impacts on public sentiment. So it's not just the health impact, it's the public sentiment impact. And negative public sentiment, of course, has a direct impact on rising crime, rising levels of civil unrest.
In 2019, prior to the coronavirus pandemic, there were waves of middle-class protests in many parts of the world focusing on economic inequality. Keimer says in middle-income countries, particularly ones with pre-COVID social problems, the economic hardship of the pandemic is likely to make matters worse.
With the lockdown in South Africa, we're already seeing protesters gathering on the streets demanding the right to protest because they're seeing that, you know, that right has been taken away by the lockdown.
Regardless of their COVID numbers, all of the world's middle-income nations face potentially crushing economic impacts. Most don't have the financial reserves to bail out shuttered businesses or to pay workers to stay home, and they're faced with restless populations that are eager, maybe even desperate, to improve their standards of living. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
Every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
What do you have to say to the people calling for your resignation?
Goodbye.
Nothing to say.
Goodbye. Our news crew confronted a Leelanau County Road Commissioner over his use of a racial slur at a meeting earlier this week. Road Commissioner Tom Eckerly said Black Lives Matter is, quote, trying to take the country away from us, end quote. He also used a racial slur to blame the coronavirus crisis on people from Detroit. Calls for Eckerly's resignation grew again today. 9 and 10's David Lydon has tonight's top story after questioning Eckerly about his comments.
What if I could talk to you for a second?
I said, come on in, but I changed my mind. Go on out.
We tracked down Leelanau County Road Commissioner Tom Eckerly at his home near Sutton's Bay this morning, where he did not deny using a racial slur at a recent Road Commission meeting.
Do you deny the comments?
No, I don't have nothing to say to the news, because the news can't put it straight anyway. Goodbye.
Well, I'm here to make it straight right now, sir.
Goodbye.
9 in 10 News also received questions about freedom of speech relating to Eckerly's comments. Ferris State professor Dr. Christian Peterson says while the U.S. enjoys broad freedom of speech, there are limits.
If you look at someone like Thomas Jefferson, who was a vigorous defender of free speech, would not have made the argument that you won't suffer any consequences but over what you say. But it's more that you can, you know, you don't end up in prison.
As for Eckerly, he also did not want to discuss the growing number of people calling for him to resign.
What do you have to say to the Goodbye. People calling for your resignation?
Goodbye.
Nothing to say.
Goodbye.
Eckerly's fellow road commissioners are now calling for him to step down. State Senator Kurt Vanderwall released a statement today that reads, racism is totally unacceptable in our society, and Commissioner Eckerly's use of a racial slur is shocking, appalling, and cannot be tolerated. He should resign immediately, or the county should begin actions to have the governor remove him from office. And the governor's office released this statement today that reads, Governor Whitmer believes that Road Commissioner Tom Eckerly must resign immediately. His comments are atrocious. The governor has been very clear. There is no place for hate and racism in Michigan. The Leelanau County Board of Commissioners is set to meet on August 18th. Eckerly's comments will almost certainly be a topic of discussion. In Leelanau County, David Lydon, 9 in 10 News.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade. So the clip we're about to hear is about the Settlers of Catan board game. Now, Gusty happens to be very familiar with this board game. I learned about this years ago. I think even before the cows came into existence. As a non-white male victim of racism, who's actually called into the cows before, he likes this board game. I think he and his sister and family members have played this board game. He introduced it to me. I liked it, started playing it. The gist of the game is it's colonization, basically. You and how many other people are going to play. You try to build your settlement, your colony, as quickly as possible. Like, the board has different resources that you gather, and you compete against everybody else to see who can build it up. And you accumulate points as you build different settlements and roads and things with the resources on the board. The thing that's intriguing about this game is that the board is never the same. Like, you roll the dice like you do with a lot of standard board games, but it's never the same. The resources and how the board is allocated and things, it changes every time you play, so it's always kind of a fresh experience. Anyway, the strong element of white supremacy racism to this game, now I've already told you, it's basically colonization. You go to the board, you go to a new piece of land and see who can take it over and so-called develop it quickly, the fastest. Now, there are no people, right? You have colors, right? You have little color pieces, but there are no characters, right, per se, that you have. You just have little colors for, like, your blue roads and blue settlements and things and blue towns, or red or white, but you don't have any people, right? So there's not, like, any white characters, non-white characters, nothing like that. But with this game, you try to accumulate resources, and the way you do that is you roll the dice, and so let's say the number 8 comes up. There are numbers that correspond to every location on the board game, and so every location that has the number 8 on it, bam, if that's yours, if you have a settlement that's on that particular region with the 8 on it, and they roll the dice, the number 8 comes up, bam, you get all the resources where you have a settlement and the number 8. So, there is a robber, R-O-B-B-E-R, robber piece that is black. All the other colors in the board game, white, red, blue, and orange, but the robber is black. Now, the robber is not a person either, but when they place the black robber on your location, so now if you have that particular location, the dice is rolled, it's a number 8, and you have a spot with the 8, but they have put the black robber on that spot, you do not get those resources. And that can be crucial, because sometimes, you know how, you know, luck and numbers and all that, like, sometimes you just roll 8 every time for like 5 times in a row, and if you have that resource and you don't get it, like, that can be, you know, crucial. I've seen that happen many, many times in a game. But if you play with white people, and I have in real life and online, white people have recognized the black robber as the nigger. In fact, if you look online, I bet you can find some photographs of the robber from Settlers of Catan with an afro. In fact, the person, victim, who introduced me to this game said his sibling said they were talking about the robber and racism, white supremacy, and she said, oh yeah, I've heard my white friends, oh yeah, you put the nigger on my spot, oh yeah. She said she even had some of the white people who said, oh yeah, the robber, you could just put an afro on him and have a bucket of chicken. Settlers of Catan, here we go.
In the pandemic, board games are back, and as NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, many people are turning to a classic one from Germany.
Eight again, more brick.
Family game night. We've done this a lot this year thanks to the pandemic, and my family has dusted off Monopoly, Scrabble, but we usually settle on Settlers of Catan.
Two bricks for anything.
It's a game of trade and development. Players compete for resources on an island and trade with each other in order to build settlements, cities, and roads. The most successful developer wins.
Why in the world do I need brick?
Entrepreneurs love the game. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is a fan, as is LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, who plays the game in job interviews as a way to size up an applicant. In its 25th year, Catan has sold more than 32 million units. It's one of the best-selling board games of all time.
Catan was revolutionary, and its impact continues today.
Eric Arneson is author of How to Host a Game Night. In his two decades writing about board games, he's never seen anything like Catan, a modular game where the board is different each time you play it and where the object is not obliterating your opponents, but trading with them.
Every player is involved throughout the whole game. Even when it's other players' turns, you're not sitting around waiting. The games are always quite close. Nobody ever gets eliminated. It is just a remarkable achievement in game design.
Settlers of Catan designer Klaus Teuber grew up in 1950s Germany. The country was picking up the pieces after World War II, and he passed the time playing a board game called Romans versus Carthaginians, mostly by himself. He still remembers receiving the game for Christmas.
When I opened the box of the game, I liked the scent of the game. So wonderful. There's adventure in this box.
Teuber spoke with me over an old computer and his voice sounded distant, so we asked one of our colleagues to read for him. He's 68 now, and he's just released his autobiography, My Way to Catan, to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the game. Teuber was a dental technician bored out of his mind by his job when he began creating games in his basement in the 1980s.
And I had a lot of frustration. It was for me a little bit like a holiday to be at home and to develop games, and for me to create my own worlds.
Teuber's first games did well. He won 3 Spiel des Jahre Awards, the most coveted prize in the board game industry. Then, in the early 90s, inspired by the history of the Vikings, Iceland, and the Age of Discovery, Teuber created Settlers of Catan. It was an instant hit. It also won the Spiel des Jahre, but instead of sales tapering off after a few years, they just kept climbing. He has a theory about why it became so popular.
First thing, it's variable. Every time it's a new game. You cannot destroy someone's buildings. It's impossible. And you have to communicate. I think these are actually factors that women like. In my opinion, part of the success is that women play together in the family with their husbands and with their children.
And as families shelter in place, sales of Catan continue to climb. As the pandemic sent the global economy into a downward spiral, Catan's sales skyrocketed by 144% for the first 5 months of this year. Teuber, whose 2 sons work for his company, Catan Inc., says he still plays the game with his family, but he admits he's not very good at it and that he rarely wins. He says what he enjoys most is playing it and being there with his family, something millions of other families are enjoying too.
2 bricks for free or 2 bricks for a brick and a sheep.
Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
We want beautiful babies, not ones with brown faces.
Never I say, for the Ku Klux Klan is here to stay.
Never I say, because the Ku Klux Klan is here to stay.
There are stories families tell themselves about their ancestors, about their place in the world. Edward Ball has just written a history of a man his family called our Klansman.
Constant is one of 16 great-great-grandparents. The thought has a distancing effect. The reality is that Constant, my grandmother's grandfather, is a murderous actor on behalf of his family, on behalf of us. And it is a vile taste in the mouth. I must own it in some way. He was a fighter for our gain, for my benefit. To say anything else is to prevaricate.
Edward Ball's book is called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. And he joins us now from his home in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Growing up, your Aunt Maud, the family historian, just put it out there calling him our Klansman. This New Orleans ancestor, Polycarp Constant Lacorne, was someone that you heard about. What did that phrase, our Klansman, mean?
I first heard about our Klansman, Constant Lacorne, when I was a boy in New Orleans. We were somewhat proud of him. We were somewhat ashamed of him because Klansmen were heroes to most white Southerners for most of the last 150 years. But in my childhood, that memory was changing. He was someone who'd done things important. He had helped to restore white supremacy when it was threatened in Louisiana. And nevertheless, he was kind of a notorious figure.
How do you view his place in the place of others like him who worked during Reconstruction to secure white supremacy? What was their role?
Well, it was the majority of white society that resisted the innovation of Reconstruction, which was an attempt to establish a place for African Americans as citizens. So he was working in concert with tens of thousands of other ordinary folks, some of whom joined the white militias and rampaged like he did, and others who tried to block the implementation of policies that would allow black men to vote and establish a new life after emancipation.
Yeah, white fear of black people, you write, is, quote, so old and so established that it lies like an animal asleep in the mind. That racism leads to violence. The organization against the control of the federal government, the reassertion of power over black people. And it doesn't happen in secret. Can you tell us about the sort of strange swell of volunteer firemen in New Orleans after the Civil War?
Yes. The fire departments became the place where the white militias were cultivated. After the Civil War, 500,000 embittered Confederate veterans returned to their towns in the South. And in New Orleans, quite a lot of them enlisted in the volunteer fire departments. And these organizations turned into military-like organizations. And Constant and many of his friends and family were active in fire department politics and the drills of those units. And these fire departments were responsible for some of the early marauding assaults on black society. And it was after a few years that a number of these fire departments became converted, in a way, into Ku Klux Klan units.
And can you tell us about his role in sort of a horrific massacre of African Americans and their allies?
In 1866, there was a rally for the African American vote, and several hundred black people were gathered in an auditorium. The city sent waves of police and waves of firemen to break up this meeting. Within a couple of hours, hundreds of black people were dead in the street, scattered throughout the street, some of them beaten to death, most of them shot to death. It's likely that my ancestor was on the scene, though it cannot be determined with absolute certainty, because in many massacres of this kind, and this was one of dozens that unfolded around the South during Reconstruction, there is no honor roll of killers that is preserved. And so this was the event that launched the thing we know as Radical Reconstruction. In response, Congress in Washington passed the Reconstruction Acts and extended the right to vote to black men. And it was a real pivot point in the history of U.S. politics.
This story is resonant to this moment for many reasons, but one is because you write that many white Americans may have had a Klan member in their family at some point, and that is important to know.
It's hard to believe, but approximately one half of all white Americans have in their family tree a Klansman. But most of them don't know this. I think that there is a kind of healing that can come from facing the fact that you carry the legacy of white rule and white violence. That's what I'm trying to do, is to claim this difficult history to show that it can be done and we can learn from it.
Well, may I ask, how did your family react to your telling this story? Did it heal?
It depends on whom you ask. I have a lot of family in New Orleans. And, you know, the poet Czesław Miłosz said that when a writer is born, his family is lost.
Mm. I love that quote.
Yeah, and condemned to exposure and embarrassment. Some in the family say, oh, he was a bad seed. You know, we are the good white people. He's not like us. So I think that's an understandable response that, you know, one wants to hold at arm's length a difficult story. And I think that there is some medicine that can be made from the poison that he spread.
That's Edward Ball. His new book is called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To my mother and to the memory of my father, whose migration made me possible, and to the millions of others like them who dared to act upon their dreams. I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom. Richard Wright.
The focus on Black Lives Matter remains, of course, one of the biggest subjects in the national conversation right now. A new book looks at how hierarchy and class are very intertwined in the way race and racism plays out in America. Jeffrey Brown talks to author Isabel Wilkerson. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
In 1959, Martin Luther King Jr., visiting India and seeing its caste system, realized he was a kind of untouchable in his own land. It's one of many stories told in the new book, Caste: The Origins of Our Discontent, which asks us to see our country in a new way.
I really was looking to better understand the very long-standing origins of divisions in our country. You know, the era in which we live, this era of upheaval, really requires and calls for new language, new ways of seeing one another, new ways of understanding how we interconnect, and also what we've inherited as a country and as a people.
Isabel Wilkerson is a former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, a history of the great migration of African Americans out of the South. Working on that book, she came to see something deeply embedded in American culture, even beyond race.
The word racism seemed inadequate to capture the full effect and total experience of being in a world in which every single thing that you could and could not do was based upon what you look like, a world in which everyone was in some ways consigned to preconceived notions as to who should be where, and people had to be careful to stay in their place or could it mean their very lives.
Wilkerson looks to India, where we're used to seeing caste, and to Germany, where the Nazis created a racial hierarchy that formalized persecution and ultimately genocide. Drawing on the works of past anthropologists and historians, she reveals America's own insidious and artificial caste system, a strict hierarchy with rules that set in place both privilege and privation.
You write of caste as the, quote, infrastructure of our divisions. Now, in what ways does caste help us think about what's going on in American history and now?
The word caste is a reminder of an infrastructure beneath something that something that's larger. It's something that sits beneath the foundation. It is the foundation, the framework for how people interact with one another. And so I have come to believe that caste, the infrastructure, the hierarchies that we often don't see, the bones of a thing. I think of caste as the bones and race as the skin. And that is a way to see that race is used or has been used historically as the cue, as the signal, as the indicator of where an individual fits in the pre-existing hierarchy that had been created from the time of colonial era America.
Slavery from the beginning manifests that hierarchy, one life worth more than another. But Wilkerson sees a continuity, waves of European immigrants arriving in this country and, in a sense, learning they are white, and therefore above those who aren't.
When you're in a caste system, a hierarchy, everyone is affected by it. It's about the investment in the hierarchy, how one moves about in a hierarchy. And the insidious thing about such a hierarchy is it's something that we don't see. Again, bones versus skin. You can see the skin. You can see the outward manifestations, but you don't often see those the unseen inputs and triggers and assumptions, the unconscious biases that pervade society that are there below the surface of consciousness, that have been ways that that everyone has been socialized to know and recognize who is, you know, who is very likely to be, you know, in positions of power, who is likely to be poor, who is likely to be on the margins.
Who is likely to sit in a position of power in the boardroom? Who is likely to live in certain neighborhoods? Who is likely to be stopped by police and treated with brutality? The focus of current Black Lives Matter protests.
American history is reflective of the ebbs and flows, progress and pushback. Moving forward and then receding. That's essentially the history of our country. And so this is a moment, another moment that could be potentially a sea change. I view it as being the cusp of an awakening to a part of much of American history that many people may not have known. The goal of this work is to allow us to see, again, the structure that we have inherited, to be able to push forward, but most importantly, to recognize that we all have a stake in it, and to recognize that it will take each and every one of us to make it the strongest house possible.
But, you know, I have to say that in reading this, caste, as you describe it, seems even more fixed in a sense than race as a concept, as a structure. Is it something that is fixable?
I would like to believe that it's fixable. I wouldn't have written this if I didn't think that it was. I have to remain hopeful. I have to remain I have to believe that once awakened to our history and to our current reality, as has occurred in recent months, that this would move all of us to want to bridge these divides, to find ways to scale the walls that have been built between us, and to recognize that these are false and artificial divisions. These are man-made divisions, and if they were made by man, then they can also be fixed by man.
All right. The book is Caste, Isabel Wilkerson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I'm a racist, it's because I don't like Japs. I just don't trust them. I just don't trust them. You won't find anything in my house that comes from Japan.
At exactly 15 minutes past 8 in the morning, on August 6, 1945, Japanese time, at the moment when the atomic bomb flashed above Hiroshima, Miss Toshiko Sasaki, a clerk in the personnel department of the East Asia Tin Works, had just sat down at her place in the plant office and was turning her head to speak to the girl at the next desk. That rather ordinary sentence is the opening to the extraordinary August 1946 New Yorker article titled Hiroshima. It was published a year after the United States dropped the first nuclear bomb on that city, a year in which the U.S. government had gone to great lengths to conceal the human devastation caused and to depict the bomb as a conventional, humane weapon. Well, the writer of the piece, John Hersey, uncovered a very different story reporting on the ground in Japan. Author and journalist Leslie Bloom chronicles Hersey's work and the reaction to it in her new book, Fallout. She joins me now from Los Angeles. Leslie Bloom, welcome.
Thank you.
Start with who John Hersey was and how he came to be the one to tell this story.
Well, John Hersey was a young World War II correspondent who had covered action in different theaters throughout the war for Time magazine. And like many war correspondents then, he was pretty supportive of the U.S. military, and he even wrote an almost overly complimentary wartime bio of General Douglas MacArthur. And that the U.S. military knew him and trusted him would be an important factor in my story and how he eventually got his story about Hiroshima. And I don't want to give away too much, but I will say that how he got in was by being the perfect Trojan horse reporter.
The perfect Trojan horse reporter. Well, you've hooked us. We're intrigued. Once he got there, he didn't report this out as a war correspondent. He focused very much on ordinary people, and he picked six of them. Why did he want to tell the story in that way?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the bombing of Hiroshima was widely reported when it happened. And it was reported as a very big end of days story. I mean, there were pictures of the mushroom clouds that were released and pictures of the landscape devastation. But there were no pictures that were released or no stories that were released about the human toll that had happened on the ground there. And the government was really going to enormous lengths to cover up the reality of the atomic aftermath in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were very concerned with, as the former Secretary of War put it, not being seen as having outdone Hitler in atrocities. So Hersey and his editors at the New Yorker magazine became determined to tell the story from the point of view of survivors. You know, these are among the only humans who have ever experienced what it's like to be on the receiving end of nuclear attack. He ultimately picked a widow with young kids, a young female clerk, two medics, a priest, and a minister with a young family. And his idea was to create a sense of empathy in his readers with these individuals, because after all, not everybody could understand the physics of how the bombs worked or visualize, you know, an all-out nuclear attack, but anyone could relate to being a mother or a father or a colleague or a doctor who was going about their everyday business when catastrophe strikes.
Yeah. I wonder if you would give us a sense, just one telling story of what he did find when he was there, what it was that so shocked American readers who had no idea what was unfolding in Japan.
One story that particularly resonated with him is he interviewed a young female clerk who was in her company when the bomb was detonated.
This is the clerk I mentioned in the intro.
Exactly. One of the most famous introductions in journalistic history. And when the bomb exploded over her factory, bookshelves fell upon her and she was nearly crushed to death by books. And he thought how ironic it was to have somebody nearly crushed by books within the first moments of the atomic age. And literally when he was leaving Hiroshima and standing on the surprisingly intact train station platform, he thought that he was going to have to write about that line. And that's one of the incidents that most resonated with readers.
So August 1946, The New Yorker publishes. What was the reaction, both in the United States and around the world, to this story?
Well, in Hersey's own words, the reaction was, quote, explosive. I mean, I try not to use that word in my book for obvious reasons, but he did. And the article was simply titled Hiroshima, and it comprised nearly the entire contents of the August 31st, 1946 issue of The New Yorker. It sold out immediately. There were even black market copies of it going for, you know, astronomical sums. It was syndicated in its entirety. And this is a 30,000-word story in newspapers across the country and around the world. And editors and reporters and readers were enraged. They were horrified by the testimonies in Hersey's Hiroshima. And they also began demanding to know, what else was the U.S. government withholding from the U.S. public? And then when President Truman was asked by a reporter if he had personally read it, he retorted, I never read The New Yorker. It just makes me mad. But the fact is that the government had been put very much on the defensive. That said, you know, they didn't want to look like they were on the defensive, but they were. And they had to scramble to try to reclaim the narrative.
John Hersey, as you document, was famously not about garnering publicity. He hid out and didn't give interviews about this the way
he was a publicist's nightmare.
Right. A publicist's nightmare. Absolutely. Do we know, though, if he felt like the article accomplished what he hoped it would in terms of being a wake up call to Americans to consider what their government had done in their name?
Yeah, he did feel that he had contributed to deterrence. I mean, the fact is that there has not been another nuclear attack, you know, in the vein of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Hersey said that, quote, what has kept the world safe from the bomb since 1945 has been the memory of what happened at Hiroshima. And thanks in large part to him and those brave enough to share their stories of survival with him, we know what really happened in Hiroshima and how horrible it was. So in many ways, Hiroshima has become, you know, a pillar of deterrence. That said, Hersey was very worried by the 1980s when the Cold War was surging again, that as the memory of Hiroshima dimmed, it was beginning to lose its potency as a deterrent. And that's really to the peril of all. And now, you know, look where we are. We're, you know, in the most dangerous nuclear landscape ever.
Yeah. What made you want to tell this story now?
Well, look, I mean, over the past 4 years, to be honest, I have been angered and disgusted by the unprecedented journalists are the enemy of the people assault on our free press. These attacks have also felt very personal to me. My father was a journalist. He was Walter Cronkite's writer and speechwriter. I have spent my professional life in newsrooms working alongside people of enormous integrity who have devoted their lives to the public good. And I wanted to write a historical story reminding Americans of the profound importance of our press and of investigative journalism, and that journalists at their best are working for the common good. And Hersey's story was the purest, sharpest example of that that I could find. And, you know, as you say, although he never sought the spotlight himself, I also hugely admired his deep decency. And I feel like we all need a dose of that in this country right now.
And what you're noting, if I'm hearing you right, is this is a story, of course, about John Hersey. It's a story about Hiroshima. It's also a story about the power of journalism and one journalist to change the world.
Absolutely.
Leslie Bloom. She's the author of Fallout, The Hiroshima Cover-Up and the Reporter Who Revealed It to the World. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. White girl, 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 I got you. White girl, white girl, white girl, white girl, I got you. White girl, white girl, white girl, white girl, white girl.
There was already a lot embedded in the name Karen, but it really caught on after this incident in New York.
There is an African-American man. I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog.
That was Amy Cooper, whose false charge eventually ended up getting her charged in New York last month. The internet then dubbed her the Central Park Karen. So what's in a name, and that name in particular? We asked another Karen, Karen Grigsby Bates, from our Code Switch team to explain.
Karen has become shorthand for a certain kind of woman. She's usually white, entitled, and very sure that what she's doing is right. On screen, Reese Witherspoon often plays her, as she did here in Little Fires Everywhere.
So, rent is $300 a month. That is well below market. And it's really not about the money for us. I've lived in Shaker all my life. My parents left this rental to me. The point is to rent to someone who can enjoy it.
Karen Atiya is the global opinions editor at the Washington Post, and at first this explosion of Karen's amused her. Now, not so much.
Usually when the name Karen is trending, I'm bracing myself, to be honest with you.
Because they're usually not nice depictions. Atiya has heard all the objections, that calling women Karen is classist, misogynistic, maybe even racist. But she says, nope.
Someone isn't calling someone a Karen because, you know, they were born white. That's not the issue. It is a name for a behavior. It is a name for a choice.
These Karens, Atiya says, make the choice to police people of color, especially black people. Everything from their legitimate right for their bodies to be in public spaces to their bodies, period. And before there was all this focus on Karen, there was Becky. Remember this?
Oh my God, Becky, look at her butt. It is so big. She looks like one of those rap guys' girlfriends.
For the hip-hop impaired, those are the opening lines of Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back, the 90s hit that immortalized Becky and made her popular shorthand for a certain kind of culturally oblivious white girl. But before there was Karen or Becky, there was Miss Anne, who might go back as far as the antebellum South and who for sure was around in the Jim Crow era.
My name's Meredith Clark. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia.
Meredith Clark says Miss Anne is an intra-group reference that's lasted for generations.
I remember my mother, whose mother was a domestic, talking about Miss Anne and Mr. Charlie, so a white man and a white woman, and using those to refer to these people without directly referring to them, kind of engaging in that signifying process that we think about when black folks are talking about one thing but saying another.
But whether she's wearing hoop skirts or athleisure wear, Clark says, there's been a certain consistency from Miss Anne to Becky to Karen.
The thing that makes Miss Anne, Miss Anne, is that she recognizes her privilege and she uses it almost as a cudgel or weapon to keep certain folks in their place, to keep black people in particular in their quote-unquote place.
As in this 2018 viral video from San Francisco.
She calling police on an 8-year-old little girl. You can hide all you want. The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Yeah, and illegally selling water without a permit? Yeah.
On my property.
It's not your property.
The Washington Post's Karen Atiya says this willingness to call the police to resolve disputes to her satisfaction makes Karen not only a pain, but dangerous.
again, to me, Karen is no longer the sort of annoying person who like wants to see your manager. She's the one who's willing to mobilize violence against you because she can.
Which is why in San Francisco, a member of the Board of Supervisors introduced the Karen Act. It's an acronym for Caution Against Racially Exploitative Non-Emergencies, and it would fine people who intentionally make racially biased 911 calls. Meanwhile, a lot of well-behaved Karens are hoping their name's 15 minutes is up soon. They're hoping Karen is replaced by someone else's name. Anybody else's name. Please. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
The summer of our discontent. As the numbers of the dead inexorably rise from those who succumb to the rigors of COVID-19, so too does the social discontent with the state of governmental incompetence. As I suggested in an earlier commentary, politicians make poor physicians. For doctors are trained to give patients necessary but bad news. Politicians, meanwhile, struggle to please their audiences. No bad news allowed. But sometimes, as shown by this pandemic, bad news is a necessary truth. No amount of happy talk or sweet political promises will change such grim realities. And now children, are being blithely tossed into the hungry maw of COVID-19 so that politicians can ensure that their parents return to work to fuel the engines of capital. Those parents, like the children, are but living experiments of a social test. By forcing both to return to work and to school, will they survive COVID-19 or will they not? The same political and economic forces that caused the preemptive opening of states and businesses several weeks ago, sparking a surge of COVID-19 infections, is now pushing for more reopenings with predictable results. Workers and their children are being offered as sacrifices for political and economic gain. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Heard that word experiment a lot today in the broadcast, today period. This is our weekly broadcast, the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, questions. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Long list of things to share before we get started. Number one, we are in Washington, D.C. Counter-Racist, the Cows Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Man, oh man, it seemed like the whole world is falling apart, literally. We had the Rona and the protests and Hurricane Isaias. We were getting flash flood warnings en route, and while we were hearing all that, in spite of, we've been hanging out in D.C. past few days, No bloodshed, no injuries that I'm aware of. Seems like it has been somewhat pleasant. So we'll share some of that. The first thing I told folks earlier today, the first thing to discuss. So we are in Washington, D.C. Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing, Neely Fuller Jr., longtime residents of the district. So Dr. Welsing hosted her Welsing Institute lectures right here in D.C. at Howard University for decades, right? One of her students, Sabrina Johnson, she's been a guest on the COWS multiple times. She attended the lectures over many years. She and Dr. Welsing traveled together, and Ms. Johnson was a dedicated student of Dr. Welsing's, and she, in fact, has taken over the Welsing Institute lectures. She was able to visit for a little while today. Was outstanding for many reasons. Even if she was not a serious attempted counter-racist, she brought us Cool Whip, non-dairy Cool Whip, and cornstarch, which allowed for vegan vanilla pudding, which is in the refrigerator. I suspect we could eat it now, but it'll be even better by the end of the program because it will be fully chilled. So yay, we would not have had vegan banana pudding without Sabrina Johnson, and or we could have had it, but she brought us the non-dairy Cool Whip, which is super. And this is not even just vegan homemade banana pudding. This is vegan homemade banana pudding with vegan Cool Whip and homemade vanilla wafers. Excited. Anywho, so Sabrina Johnson, she brought us the goodies. In addition, she talked about, you know, racism, white supremacy, business as usual. And she was sharing some of her views on what's going on and why whites are behaving, conducting themselves as they are with all of the racist attacks and such that we have seen over the past 4 or 5 months. And she shared one anecdote. We talked about white dog. Wow, we talked about white dog so much. Anyway, she shared an anecdote. She was talking about not understanding white people. And she said a friend of hers, this is a black male, he worked with a white guy. And this white guy had a gold chain on. And it had a pendant of some sort. And the black guy saw it and he didn't know what it was. He couldn't make it out. So one day he sees this white guy and he stops him. We'll say Bill. Hey, Bill, you got that gold chain thing. What is that thing hanging on your chain? I keep saying I don't know what that is. What is that, man? And so Bill comes and he looks him straight in the face. Miss Johnson, she says, it's a raccoon's penis. Just like the penis you got. Now, technically, that is workplace racism, because that's how she started that anecdote, that her black male friend or person that she knows was at work. This was a coworker. So Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, if anybody has the immediate response to, I am wearing a raccoon penis, just like the penis you got. If you got the ready-made response for that one, let's hear it this coming Thursday. But man, oh man. It was a hoot to chat it up with Sabrina Johnson. She was distanced, had her mask on, and all that good stuff. So it was grand to chat it up with her, and hopefully we'll be able to have her on the program. And since she's doing the Welsing Institute, I asked her, I said, man, are you going to be doing it moving forward in the fall? Like I wanted to ask, like, do you know if Howard's even going to be open, like the campus in the fall or what have you? But she said they're just doing it virtually for the time being. And I was like, I could see some benefits to that. Like we could participate conceivably if, you know, it's virtual. So I told her I would drop her, I would email her, and she said she would send me the details so I can give it to the folks at the retreat and then share it with listeners as well. So if anybody would be interested in participating in the virtual Welsing Institute, continuing with Sabrina Johnson leading, sharing information, send me an email and I will forward as I get details. So I did take a number of notes on the audio segments. We'll share those. Certainly we're System of White Supremacy. This is the compensatory call-in, so we will make sure to get to all of that. But, hey, we have been in Washington, D.C. For the past 4 or 5 days this week. This was all planned before the Rona, thinking we would be able to come here and hang out, go to the Smithsonian and do some yoga in the park and lots of other wonderful things. And the Rona changed all of that. We started out with a smaller group. We were supposed to, man, I still get bitter about it. I said that so many times while we were here. I still get bitter about Toronto. I was so excited about being there. And we had like a half dozen people, almost 2 dozen people were going to be outside the country, which seems impossible now. I saw a report they were fussing at individuals classified as white for sneaking across the border into Canada, which is, you know. Anywho, so our retreat in D.C. was going to have to be smaller just for, you know, obvious reasons at this point, if going forward at all. It seemed, you know, every other day thinking, man, I don't even know. Like, is it feasible? Are we going to be able to go? Are we going to be able to do it? And we finally got organized, and I think there were five of us that we're going to go. We had lost a few just because we had a black couple in California. I was so awed and humbled at folks coming all the way from California to do the retreat in D.C. But we started the month. California was like Washington State and doing better and blah, blah, blah. By the time we got to the end of July, what did we hear at the audio report? They're talking about shutting off utilities because they got house parties in California contributing to the Rona. That's what 2020 has been in. Anyway, so they did not feel safe making that trip, which is totally logical. What can you do? So anyway, we had five people, I believe. It's going to be small anyway. We had lost like three people. We had lost three. It's going to be five of us. So literally, I check in for my flight on Monday. Get a message that one of the folks can't make it, family emergency, has already paid up and was excited about going and is bummed just that they can't be there because they wanted vegan banana pudding. Who doesn't? Get on the plane, get here. Hey, still be nice number of us. We'll have fun. We're at the grocery store the day that people are like hours before check-in at the grocery store. Last few victuals and everything. Make sure we got everything prepared. Get back, get a message. Person can't make it, emergency. Like, super bummed. So we end up having a much smaller group just because repeated emergencies and not even things where it's like, oh man, I'm bummed they won't be here. Like, wow, like this has just been a terrible year where people had family members who got ill and or just even had workplace racism. For one, it wasn't even the Rona. When I read it, I said, oh wow, that's workplace racism, really. But anyway, we still had a few folks who were able to make it in spite of. You can ask them directly if we were able to have safe, fun time. But we did yoga while we were here. We did plant-based meals while we were here the entire time. Racism, white supremacy, discussed anti-blackness, self-care. As I said, we had a visit from Sabrina Johnson today. You can, you know, hear how their experience was directly. We'll be able to chat. They can share about the food or whatever they like. Our folks that are with us here in D.C. live, if you want to get prepared, unmute. Hopefully remember all the technical difficulties. That's one thing that I have said, I think, over the years on the program, that most of the people who listen to this program, probably the case with most podcasts, most listeners don't listen live. They listen, you know, at their leisure, whenever. So it's always a hoot, at least for me, at the retreats to see people who, you know, have said, I never listen live. I have no idea what the procedure is for live participation. I don't do any of that. I just listen to the archives. Lots of appreciation to Mr. Fox. Like that. I just listen on YouTube or whatever it is. I never listen live. I have a schedule and am doing things. I just listen to the archives. So That is why we work hard to make sure they're there and right on. So hopefully we'll have our folks who will be ready to roll. And if you are ready, we'll start. You all can share, as I said, just if you want to give how you'd like to be referenced and then anything you'd like to share about your experience, yoga-wise, food-wise. I guess if I was going to make a request, at least something about the food, but yoga-wise, food-wise, if we were safe and anything else, if you are all ready, proceed.
Hi, this is Miss Keys from North Carolina. This is my second yoga retreat. I was at the first one in Virginia, and now I'm here in D.C. It has been so relaxing and wonderful. The food has been excellent. I've gotten plenty of rest. Some of my favorite dishes, the portobello mushroom hamburger, that was really good. The fried rice with the bok choy and the egg rolls, excellent. And now, I'm excited because after the program, I'll be having banana pudding. Oh, and, the sweet potato pie was also excellent. And that's my report.
Hi, I'm Tracy, and I'm from upstate New York. And to be quite honest with you, I am not a yoga fan. And the only reason why I actually came was for the rest and relaxation. But I have to say that my favorite yoga positions were done on the wall. So anything that deals with wall in yoga, I am for it. But I had like a really great time. The food really was excellent. I'm not a plant-based person like completely. I've tried it, but I still have to have my chicken. But yeah, the food was great. Gus fed us really well. And yeah, that sweet potato pie, excellent. I did really enjoy it. And actually, all of the food that he's cooked, I've tried it, and I actually want recipes for it. Like that macaroni and cheese, well, actually, it was a cheeseless macaroni and cheese. That was excellent. And, yeah, the portobello mushrooms, because I eat portobello mushrooms anyway, but I never eat the marinated, but Gus marinated it, and it was perfect. The rest, I've been resting since I got here. So it's been great. And I have to say another thing about the food. It's so water rich. And if you find that you really don't like to eat plant-based foods, you really should try it just so that you can have an easy time just going to the bathroom. And I found that all the water in the foods that we ate, because everything was water-based. Zucchini had water in it. Broccoli is water-rich. Everything we ate, watermelon, had water in it. And it was so easy just to go to the bathroom. And just for that, changing your diet to a plant-based would be excellent for you. So that is my report. Thank you.
Detailed. That was our small crew for the retreat, which made social distancing super easy. Nobody was bribed or paid off for the food. And I mean, pause for the food. Chef Nadira, anybody that's been at the retreats, Miss Keys, you heard from her first, right? She said she was in Virginia. Chef Nadira put a stamp on the Cows Retreats. I said it repeatedly. I've said it for a while. We would not be here if she had not made, she and her sister-in-law, if they had not made such amazing food in Virginia. Like, that was so helpful because we had mud and rain and just so many obstacles to deal with. And the food held it together. So I was concerned knowing Nadira was not going to be here to do all the cooking and that I had to hold it down. And I mean, she has really high standards for cuisine. I think anyone who has tasted her food can attest. So I'm glad to hear folks at least enjoy and are looking for some of the recipes. That's one of the things that I think is so great about the retreats, and why I wish more of the folks had been able to get here, and hope that the folks who had family emergencies, hope that their relatives are doing well, recovering quickly, and are eating well. Because eating well, eating this type of food, plant-based foods, we're talking today, getting more water, not all those preservatives and everything, that right there helps your immunity. Being able to go, exactly what you just heard from Tracy, because I, when she said that, she shared that yesterday, like, wow, low transit time. Dr. Ruby Lathan, she's been on the cast, on the cows repeatedly. Visit her website, rubylathan.com. She has plant-based recipes, everything. She's been great. We're supposed to do yoga down in Oregon this year. She talked about reduced transit time, how so many people eating a bad diet, you end up with all those toxins in your system. Exactly like Tracy was saying, you end up being constipated, taking a really long time to go to the bathroom. There are so many people who suffer with irritable bowel syndrome. They got lots of titles that they'll put on it. Start eating a better diet. You will see a lot of improvements and getting more fiber, which is still a part of being eating a better diet, but getting more fiber. But yeah, I just, it was planned. You can see some of the food that we ate. You can see some of the pictures. I posted them on social media, so you can check out. I think the egg rolls are there. The portobello mushrooms are there. The sweet potato pie is there. The banana pudding is there, but you can check it out. See what we ate. I'll see if I can share the recipes and what have you. But plant-based cooking, it does not have to be tedious. It does not have to be just bland and eating the same thing, steamed vegetables and salads and that type of thing. You can, everything that we named, you can have all of that. You can have, we had pizza, all of the things that you enjoy, foods that you like, you can have them and make them really healthy. Lots of vegetables, lots of greens. And still have people think your food is tasty. Best of everything. No idea when we'll be able to do a retreat again because the Rona just... I told folks I was kind of sitting around. People who heard, I was sitting around last week like, So I guess maybe next week we'll be in D.C. We'll have to see. And I felt that way all the way up until the time the plane took off. Like, maybe we'll land. We'll have to see. But... we'll see how it goes. Hopefully we'll be able to land, get back to Seattle safe and sound, and then we'll wait 2 weeks to make sure that everyone is safe and, you know, back to their respective locations. We did watch White Dog. Well, I guess if I could make one request, if y'all have any thoughts, because we did watch White Dog while we were here, and we had folks who have been paying attention somewhat to the book club, so they have been following. Any thoughts from the film White Dog? Give them a second to see if they can get unmuted.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, Tracy.
Oh, keto. Okay, the only thing that I have to say about White Dog is this. White people cannot be redeemed. I don't care how much you got a white friend, if you got a white friend, or if you know white people who have done some good things for you, I don't care. They cannot and will not be redeemed. And that's it for me.
This is Miss Keys from North Carolina. And we've had White Dog encounters since we've been here in D.C. I didn't realize how many white dogs were in the areas. It was very shocking. So that's my report on that.
Much obliged. Thank you all for sharing. We were able to take a walk yesterday. Man, whew, it is a whole report. Just Ms. Johnson talked to us about how much D.C. has changed with the white invasion, racial dislocation. Wow. We went to what is it? The Yards. That's what it's called. So this is like a park on the water in Washington, D.C., and it's directly adjacent to where the baseball team, the Major League Baseball team is. So we're walking and like dogs all over the place. I mean, they have dog parks. we saw about as many dog parks as we did black people for a while. Like, it was amazing. Some of the dogs were aggressive, seemed like they could have been right out of Romaine Gary's book. Some of them were the color white, and some of them just had the conduct of a white dog. But yes, it was amazing. If I could give, I'll give one quick anecdote, then we'll get our callers. I got a shirt from a Cows listener that says, to the black woman, thank you. Long story behind the shirt, but I had it on yesterday, and almost all of the stories that I have associated with this shirt are bad. Like, it's never someone just saying something nice or a compliment. And that never happens. Like, almost all the stories are bad. Anyway, so yesterday I have the shirt on, and a black female, she sees it, she walks by, and she says, you are very welcome. And she had a big smile. I thought it was like one of the funniest things of the day. But that did happen. She had a mask on. That did happen yesterday while I had on my to the black woman, thank you, T-shirt. Whew. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Thanks to Sabrina Johnson. That's how we got vegan banana pudding. Sabrina Johnson. And great information. Raccoon penis. Come on. Let's see. Folks who dialed in *61. If you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, everybody. Salutations. Another Saturday in the system. I hope everybody's doing well. I'm glad the retreat's going well. Gus, I don't know if you remember to print out your bookmarks. I hope you did before you left. But anyhow, if you didn't, you know, no sweat. I wanted to, let me see, Isabel Wilkinson. She's a highly educated woman, and that's, you know, can't be debated, but to me, she comes across a little bit naive still on the system, because it's my opinion through my observation and education on caste systems that caste systems only apply when everyone in that caste system is of the same so-called race. So for us, we're not in a caste system where it's race. And that's a big difference. And I'm not saying that people, you know, aren't mistreated in the caste system. Obviously they are, but it's a different psychology. And, you know, I just don't think it applies what she's saying about caste systems. I saw a documentary, or I listened to like a little, I guess you could say, dissertation by a white person on the Khoisan people in Papua New Guinea. And he was talking about how they were basically African people, but, you know, they're a little bit different. And he went as far to say they're one of two groups of people that splintered off from Homo sapiens. And I find that interesting because the synonym for that would be human, or, you know, so I was like, okay, well, if they're not Homo sapien, what are you saying they are? He never said what they were, though. Someone asked me about why are people having corona parties in New Orleans. And I said, you know, I don't know, you have to ask them. I said, but I do know white people have hurricane parties as well. And what I mean by that is, if the white people know that the hurricane is close by, if it's hitting a lower lying area like Grand Isle or Plaquemines Parish and not directly hitting New Orleans, they'll have a party. And if it's hitting another state, they'll have a party. So I said to them, I wasn't surprised that they were having corona parties at all. The thing on Japan was interesting because someone today told me about how they're being mistreated by Japanese people on the job. And I said to him, next time they mistreat you, I said, ask them, who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Ask them who did that. Was it? Ask them if it was black people or not black people and see what they say. You know, maybe that was, I don't know how constructive that is, but that was what I would do. And as far as the report on kids going back to school, I'm advocating right now for my son to just do his senior year remotely with a 504 plan, which is not necessarily special education, but it's saying that there are special provisions needed for him to finish school. And I'm doing that because, one, I don't want him to get sick, and two, I found out since he's had some medical issues that basically there's an environment of rampant drug use with the students. And I found out his freshman year, he was actually offered cocaine in the bathroom by upperclassmen, and he never said anything, I guess, for fear of reprisal from that student. But so many reasons why we should try to keep our kids home right now, because the schools were already dysfunctional in a lot of ways before Corona. I don't know how they'll be able to handle this. They obviously can't, based on the reports. And that's all I had to say for now. And thanks. Have a great night.
Number one, thank you so much for reminding me about the bookmarks. Jeez, I said up until pretty much until the flight actually took off, I was thinking, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get there. So I totally forgot, but I'm so glad you reminded me, and I have my laptop right here. So I will make sure that bookmarks are passed out. Reading is, I said that today. Sabrina Johnson came by to visit. We talked about White Dog and all the symbolism within the book. She talked Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, because, yeah, reading is more important than watching television. Thank you so much for reminding me about the bookmarks, because I totally forgot. I do not have children. I heard that while we were at the retreat. Folks saying, hey, if I had, you know, a child who is school age, this would be the catalyst for ending their tenure in the public school system. You got about 9 billion reasons to sever all ties at this point with everything that's happening right now. Just, we're talking about that during the retreat. So I think that's outstanding, advocating that your child finish out his, even though I can see that because, I mean, they have so many. What is all the cliche things? Just like the senior prom, like, oh my gosh, does that mean I missed the prom? And, you know, all the other things that are supposed to happen, during senior year. But man, yeah, health, many more things are in priorities. That's a big part of what you're supposed to learn graduating, priorities. Nothing more important than your health. That's what we've been saying this weekend. Isabel Wilkerson, who is still gorgeous, black female. I said, I can't say I'm excited about this book, But she did write The Warmth of Other Suns, which is in my top 10, even though I did have critiques. But I mean, hey, it is a phenomenal book. So she wrote a new book. She used a number of metaphors. Bridge the divide. Scale the wall. She used a number of metaphors in talking about the unconscious. But anybody, when they start talking about white supremacy, racism in a world of white dog, and did white dog end up that way because of unconscious bias? Rhetorical, as they say. Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Hello?
Greetings, B, in Toronto.
Greetings, Koss. Greetings, participants of the retreat in Washington, and greetings to callers and listeners. It's wonderful to hear the program and to hear the insights of how the retreat is going. It's wonderful to hear. I am absolutely interested in finding out the recipe about that banana pudding. That would be absolutely amazing. So I have a report and a question. The report first. What I've been noticing in Toronto is that a lot of people in the city are starting to get very relaxed regarding the personal protective equipment, the PPE. Within the establishments, the various vendors, due to the regulations, the health regulations outlined by the Ministry of Health, states that one has to wear a mask while inside the establishment, being a grocery store, restaurant, even going to a hospital, and also working on the job, especially if not able to do social distancing. Outside, the mask is not really required. However, there are still quite a number of people, more than 10, that are gathering together, not social distancing, the masks are coming off. And I've been hearing reports that the wave 2 of the coronavirus has hit Canada. So I can only expect numbers to go up again as a result, more so through the coming months. So my question is to all who are listening, what is your safety plan in terms of health, in terms of protection, in terms of finances, and if you have that safety plan and if you've implemented, how successful has it been so far? And the reason why I'm mentioning this is when you have the pandemic happening, compounded by aggression from whites, compounded by the restrictions to business and employment as a result, how does one navigate through such circumstances? So, for instance, I have a friend of mine who has a young son who is diagnosed with autism. The son tends to go through a variety of outbursts that requires behavior modification to help self-regulate. So the concern that the parent had was that if the son happened to be going out in the community with a support worker or in a group and the police were able to stop by noticing the son had an outburst, you know, the police might get violent unnecessarily towards the son, thinking that somehow this person is of full control and not knowing of the diagnosis. So one of the things that I had suggested to him was to definitely enter the son into what's known as a vulnerable persons registry so that, for instance, TPS, which is Toronto Police Services, has a free vulnerable persons registry in which you can register a vulnerable person, be it that person who is diagnosed with a disability, and the disability could be developmental, could be physical, could be mental health, could be substance abuse, have them entered onto that registry so that the police will have access. So if for any reason the police is called, at least they'll have access to that information ahead of time so that hopefully they'll be able to take care of the situation if needed. And that could also add a layer of protection because the police cannot say they did not know. They would have had the information ahead of time. So that's probably one area of the safety plan that might help. Another portion of the safety plan is to continue wearing your mask, continue practicing social distancing. If you can have your child continue their education remotely, do so, just as Irie is doing as well. So, yes, that would be my question, and I would take it offline. And again, wonderful to hear that the retreat was able to still take place, and that's amazing. Thank you.
Much obliged, be in Toronto. Miss Johnson, when she visited with us today, she talked about safety. One of the things that she talked about, in particular in terms of the violence aspect, visualizing extreme events, and that could even apply in other areas, economics, loss of a job, or whatever that might be, and to be thinking about that and how you would respond. And she said the reason is because these things happen, and she just started going through different scenarios and pointing out things and just be thinking about that, because in the moment, you get, look, raccoon penis might get overwhelmed in the moment. If you start thinking, and she was comparing it to other disciplines where you practice, and sometimes that's what you do. You know, you think about extreme situations so that you're already thinking about how you would respond in those type of situations so that you already have some foundation of a code, some idea of strategy about how to, what to do, what to say, what not to do, what not to say. So definitely with situations about violence, like I said, that can apply to economics in terms of safety. I think speaking up is a big one. I had to employ that getting here. There were white people. It was the best flight I've had ever flying here. The plane was half empty. I had a whole row to myself. And most of the flight attendants were non-white, essential workers. So anyway, everyone on the plane had a mask and all that. It was half empty. Had a row to myself. The people behind me, classified as white, they kept taking their mask off. Stewardess chastised them immediately. Put your mask back on. Blah, blah, blah. Later in the flight, I turned around. They had taken their mask off. I immediately, bang, hit the little button, call the attendant. I just pointed. Didn't even say anything. Just pointed behind me. It was a black attendant, too. He looked. He said, "Thanks, sir. Hey, put your mask back on. Not going to get time." It's like, yes. Yeah. In fact, I forgot. Man, Irie, do you know how much has happened? So I can even pause right there. Now, the same thing that I've been saying about safety. What have I said? If you go to a grocery store, anywhere really, bank, post office, your job, and you're in the parking lot, you see some sort of an altercation and a white person is getting rowdy, violent, aggressive, leave. It's nothing to talk about. It's nothing to think about. It's time to go. Assume that this white person is armed. They would not be getting that violent and aggressive, especially if they're escalating things, if they didn't have an advantage. I'm trying to go to the grocery store, literally. This is the night before I have to get my flight, like less than 12 hours before I'm in the air. I'm going to the grocery store just to grab a last second thing. I look, I'm going to say 30 yards from the door of the store, a good distance. I look, and there, like right in front of the store, basically, is a white man. He looks like he's probably in his 50s, I'll say, a white man and a black male, and it's like a big crowd. Like, I'm talking like 20, 25 people, maybe even more than that. And they're all just, you know, like, it's like if you can remember, like, in school when a fight would happen and everybody would get, like, in a big circle to watch, like, ooh, ooh, get him, get him. It was that type of thing. Like, they all got their phones out recording, watching, right? And so this white guy's, what, I'll mess you up, I'm cursing. He goes and he takes his finger and pushes this black guy in the head. And so I'm watching all this. And I'm like, I've got a plane to catch. And like, Same thing that I said here. I turned around. Now I'm upset because I'm like, man, I've got things doing. I turned around. I was like, oh, I've got my phone. I'm not pulling my phone out to, you know, record. I pulled my phone out. 911. There is a white man being violent and hostile. He's threatening people in the parking lot. I said, oh, really? Can you give us a description? Blue t-shirt, shorts, boom, boom, white male. First thing I said, white male threatening. Grant, I said, I'd like to make an anonymous report. I said, oh, okay. I was doing all this as I was still walking away, but I called the police. Man, Washington State Police, do you know the police were here in less than 60 seconds? Bam, rolled up. I had barely got an opportunity to put my phone away. Bam, officer rolled up. And it was a black officer. And he hopped out of the vehicle with a rifle. Amazingly, everyone calmed down. The white man who, I'll mess you up. What do you think you are? Yes, officer. I would like to say, man. I went to the store at that point. Thank you, black police officer. You are the best. Citizens can go back and use the store. Call the enforcement. That's exactly what I said. Call the enforcement officers as you are exiting. You're in your vehicle or what have you. Boop, boop. Roll up the windows, lock the door, make your call as you're leaving, and that's that. It's nothing to say. It's nothing to talk about. Like, assume that this person is armed. Take your safety very serious. Wear your mask, the gloves, all of that. And avoid being out of public, you know, big crowded spaces. That's a great, you know, piece of advice as well. Other folks can respond to B's question as we roll. But that, I would have forgotten all about that incident, I suspect, because so much has happened and, you know, all that. But that did happen just on Monday. Black police officer saved the day. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Make sure I give out the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Also, make sure folks do not wait. We have vegan banana pie, so don't wait till, you know, the last minute to speak of eating banana pudding, vegan banana pudding. But the World War II, I did want to make sure I said something about that as well. I feel like white people do, or it's not I feel, the evidence. I've concluded white people do a lot of bragging about killing, terrorizing non-white people. That's why we have all this difficulty getting Ben Tillman's statues, plural, down, all that, you know, hubbub. When they talk about the bombing, in my view, all of that is bragging. They have lots and lots of these programs where they will pull out the victims. Oh, tell us about that. Oh, your whole family died. The bookcase fell on you. They have tons of these, 75 years worth of this nonsense. They have a program from like the 1940s. Where they have a non-white victim who was bombed and they come in and have this person sit and talk with one of the white suspected race soldiers who dropped the bomb. Like, isn't this great? Did you ever think you'd meet the person who did that? Killed your whole family, huh? Isn't it wild? It's just, let's give them. Who does this? System of racism, white supremacy. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. That's who does this. *61 if you have comments to share. Other folks that we missed, totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Justin, D.C., how are you, sir? how do you like D.C.? Did you go to see the Martin Luther King statue?
I hate it. I hate it. From what I saw, now we haven't even been here for a week, but we did not go out to do any sightseeing. I just said, you know, avoid public spaces. we have been secluded. We have been right here, you know, doing yoga and vegan meals. We watched a lot of documentaries and White Dog and that sort of thing. But no, we did not. We had tickets to go to the Smithsonian. We had a reservation and everything, but that is closed still. We were going to go to the Library of Congress, but that is closed still. So, no, we did not do that. The only thing we did was we went to the park that's outside, and we stayed distant from everybody doing that. That was the only bit of sightseeing. I think we saw the Capitol building from a distance. We saw the Washington Monument from a distance. Yeah, a few other little things, but yeah, none of the major things that when you come to DC to do. But yeah, I do not like it. It's super congested. White people, you know, white people have done amazing job dislocating black people. Pet stores, the park that we went to, that was beautiful. They had lawn chairs. Like we were down, we walked, it was beautiful, but they have lawn, like they don't want you to just come and hang out at this park that's on the water downtown next to where the Nationals play baseball. They don't want you to just hang out for like 5 minutes. They want you to loiter in lawn chairs that they have provided for like hours and just sit outside and look at the water. You can go, it is beautiful, but wow. It's a lot of white people. It's super crowded. Ms. Sabrina Johnson was talking about that with us today when she visited. She said it used to be that you could just go somewhere and like we could have went to the park yesterday and had fun. Now it's got to be you have to add 45 minutes to find parking, which is exactly what happened to us when we went out yesterday. We were riding around and I'm thinking, man, I must be some kind of loser. Like we came down here and I didn't even know it's going to be all hard to find park. 40, and that's about how much time it took us to find parking. And then we got a spot, we parked, went out at the park, and I was like, wait a minute. So, like, the Nationals are playing a game, like, right now, like, live. Yes, they're playing a game live, right now. It's like, we're in the middle of the Rona, like, why are they? I said that repeatedly. I said that almost from the moment I got here. There is no way. I don't remember how many decades Dr. Welsing lived here, but bravo for her. I don't remember how long Mr. Fuller has lived here. Bravo for him. It would not be Gusty. Did that answer your question, Thomas, in New York? No, if you were talking, if you're muted.
Oh, I'm just talking.
Sorry, yeah, you're muted. Get you.
I said, I forgot what I had. So, either way, Navy SEALs are investigating footage of military dogs attacking a white soldier. I mean, a white soldier wearing a Colin Kaepernick jersey at an event. I sent you the video on this or the report. He was a white guy. He had on dog training gear under the jersey. And they have four dogs attacking them from all sides. And the crowd is just cheering as these dogs drag him to the ground. And I said, he's probably the dog trainer, you know, because not too many people are going to take on that job. You know, the dog trainer kind of knows his dogs well. They know not to go for the neck or the face, you know, when they had him on the ground. They just stayed at the arms. And I said, he's probably the dog trainer. He's probably training white dogs. Colin Kaepernick jersey. Either way, this took place last year, and the footage was just released. You know how white people tend to release footage later. The crowd was cheering as the man screamed, I'll stand, I will stand. And once they removed the dogs from him, then a bunch of Navy SEALs in full uniform with their military weapons drawn. They, you know, run up on them, put the guns in his face, you know, clear the crowd as they drag them out like it was a real, like they really had Colin Kaepernick. Unbelievable, but it's a system of white supremacy. Huge explosion in Beirut. Looked like a tactical loop. However, right on the anniversary of Hiroshima, but that was, you know, a sight to see the type of devastation on one bomb, or if, as they say, explosion. Just one explosion can have, you know. And you know, white people have a lot of things that make explosions. I had a question for everyone. Is in the light of the coronavirus, who is going to take this vaccine? Is anyone not going to take the vaccine? I hear that they're very close to having one. Trump keeps alluding to it by the end of the year. Just want to know, is anyone with our experiences under the system of white supremacy, exclusively as black people, with vaccination, you know, who is willingly going to take this vaccine? Also read this week, Gus, Amber Geiger, white supremacist female race soldier, ex-race soldier, filed to appeal her sentence just yesterday. She doesn't want a new trial. She wants the guilty conviction applied to a lesser charge like manslaughter, which will reduce her sentence. Now, mind you, she's only doing 5 out of 10 years, you know, like, I guess that's not enough reduction for her because the way they charged her, she only has to do half of the 10 years. Either way, last week, a grand jury declined to indict Dallas Police Association president for his actions in the Amber Geiger case. And if you recall from the trial, this was the guy who had tampered with some evidence right afterwards and had conversations with her that made people turn off their cameras and microphones and things of that nature. And he said that in the moment he was protecting her constitutional rights as an officer, which meant he was violating Mr. John's rights. But either way, he was not indicted and he's not stepping down. I could get the schools and I could get cracking down on these house parties. I see that, you know, but I would say give the party goers a ticket or a fine, you know. Why don't you give them all a mask, you know. But to cut people's water and power, that's the government overstepping their boundaries, in my opinion. Talk about fascism. They'll be setting a precedent that when they apply it to black people, you know, it'll be applied, you know, just cut their water in, you know. I mean, this, man, I don't agree with that. That's, to be excessive. Now, I understand the threat, you know, and they want to impose some type of, you know, why don't they find Airbnb or whoever is renting these appliances or pub? But what if it was my house, you know, and I had a family reunion or something, which is probably the wrong thing to do at this time, but I did it, and you're going to cut off my lights and water 2 days later? You know, like, I don't agree with this. From the other report you said, it seems like the nation is known as the BRICS. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. They're having quite a few economic problems behind the COVID. Not surprising. They spent the last about decade trying to crash the dollar. So in caste and race, last thing, very closely related. Man, I would like to hear the way the author puts her spin on it. I think that the casteism, if you want to call it that, might be a more powerful system than racism because it's more inclusive. It's also much older, and I think that it'll be much more difficult to get rid of casteism as opposed to racism. We'll have a lot easier time, and as difficult as racism is, it'll be a lot easier for me to get rid of that casteism. And I'll keep my line.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I think with the shutting off utilities, I think for one, unless I misread the report, I think for one, that might be something that they are going to do in some areas. I think it might be a multiple time thing, but I also had serious concerns about that being applied to black people. And I was just thinking in terms of the virus. So the problem is there's a party, right? In social distancing, virus, got all that. So to stop this, the phrase Mr. Fuller uses is solving problems without creating new problems. Now, In addition to social distancing, the thing that I've heard them say even more than hand sanitizer is wash your hands. If you tell people to wash their hands, but then you come back and threaten to cut off their water, solving problems without creating new problems. It would seem like if you cut off power, that might impact sanitation in some means too. Some people, you know, been spoiled. They like a hot shower, you know, little things like that. Other folks that we have missed totally.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. August 6, 1945, just a reminder and or information if someone did not know, the pilot of the first aircraft that dropped a bomb on Hiroshima was named Paul Tibbetts, and he grew up in Miami, Florida. He went to a local high school, the original first high school in Miami-Dade County, Miami High. The aircraft that he piloted was named after his mother. You know, as far as a supporting factor, you know, people, you know, the guys at that time would name airplanes in different ways, so he decided to name this airplane after his mother, an airplane that carried and dropped one of the most devastating devices ever in the history of the world. The actual method is that the bombs are to explode not by hitting the ground or a object, but in the air to get maximum effect, meaning the killing of the maximum amount of people. In this case, of course, everybody knows non-white people primarily. It may have been a few white people who were POWs. That's when it comes to racist white supremacy is white sacrifice. Because there was a quote-unquote prison camp, I think, in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki, where some white prisoners of war were harmed. I don't know to what extent. Nagasaki was not even the original second target. It actually was other targets, but because of the traditional bad weather in Japan, they could not see the target, and they even couldn't see the target that was eventually became Nagasaki. But it was somewhere down there, and they just released it. It had a terrible effect, but from where it exploded at, it wasn't the desired issue. And I'm explaining in this way because this is the mentality of racist white supremacists when it comes to devastating non-white people. In this case, people who are called by John Wayne yellow buck-tooth monkeys. That's my report on that bit of history that took place about 75 years ago, something like that. Recently, there was a report on two NFL employees, the players, from both of them from Miami-Dade County area, that reportedly had robbed a quote-unquote party. And I'm assuming the party was full of a whole lot of other black people. Just recently, maybe a month ago or less. And I was kind of like, you know, wondering about, that doesn't make any logical sense, because the lowest salary that you can pay a person that's a player in the NFL is something like $480,000 a year. And so I it doesn't make any sense that someone would commit commit a crime, but commit that type of crime. Come to find out what it was that was additional information that was not reported until I saw it a couple of days ago, was they were tricked, I guess, out of $70,000 in a card game, something like that. Although that still doesn't make any logical sense. It actually is silly and or stupid. But being that everybody knows that I coach football, it's not what I got into it for. But the process from high school to college to the NFL is very corrupt. It has morphed the ambitions of millions of black males in this part of the world, because you have a large numbers of black males, young black males, who are very impressionable, wanting to become a NBA player or a NFL player and not really interested in anything else. And this is just an example or the end results of the silliness of stupid things that takes place through that lack of more constructive interaction. And I would say the best interaction would be between black males and others who have influence, you know, may have influence on them that can use the platform for something more constructive. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Great job. That's why it's important to check the news, try to get information, because sometimes you might have to wait a month, a week to get additional information. That's important. Priorities. We talked about that today. Priorities. Talked about even that on this program. Priorities. Playing cards. Now, hey, I have played cards many times in my life. Mean game of spades, they say. In the middle of the Rona, we talked about how are we going to use our time and energy. We're in the middle of a global health crisis. You could be working on your craft. You could be doing lots of things, reading, writing, studying white supremacy, racism, reading Dr. Welsing, or playing cards, which leads to you being accused of committing a robbery of some sort, like, man, victims of racism, but just... how do we invest? One of our listeners said, hey, I watch real close about how I invest my time and energy and with whom I invest my time and energy. Because sometimes I end up with other people who are doing silliness. Hey, let's go play some cards. Okay. And then I end up getting all caught up in some nonsense, just messing around, something that had nothing to do with my assignment. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I thought it was a major act of racism when they discussed those college athletes talking about their safety and things that they want to happen before they come back on the field if they come out to play another white ball game. Phenomenal black self-respect. But I thought, wow, get through that whole report. You don't mention if these are non-white athletes or what have you, just talking about their wanting to address racial justice. Like, man, that's that is the problem. Black athlete, the retired firefighter, broke that down last week for, or talked about that eloquently last week for us. Other folks that we've missed totally. If you have a hand up, please do not wait till the last minute. *61. Other people we've missed totally. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Young academic, one of those tragically was supposed to be here. Even some of the folks who were in VA was like, man, that young academic, I thought he was supposed to be here. He should have been here. Good to hear from you, sir. Wish he could have been vegan banana pudding, man. And we had the carrot hot dogs. Round three, we had the carrot hot dogs.
Greetings, callers and listeners and Washington Retreat members. I wish I would have attended, but I did not want to celebrate prematurely. I originally brought the retreat with the intentions of that I would pass the praxis test, and I have been waiting a month for the result, and I have good news. I have passed. Finally received the results that I've passed through praxis, and so that hurdle is over. My next hurdle is EdTPA. It is a test in which I would have to work alongside a teacher in a classroom for 3 to 5 months for free, in which I would be recording myself and my interaction with students. I know Georgia completely banned the test because a lot of Black individuals couldn't reach initial certification. All of these standards I have to do in order to be certified as a teacher, and they were recently created. So my next hurdle would be the EdTPA. So I don't know if it's going to be canceled. So far, online, it says that I have to prepare a writer's portfolio. So I will be giving them a call first thing Monday morning, find out. But that's just the update. I wish I would have, because it would have just been comforting just to been to be surrounded by individuals like my like-minded individuals like myself when I had received the news. Mute my line.
Could have celebrated with sweet potato pie. Miss Keys, that was what she said, almost verbatim.
Congratulations, sir.
Heck, exactly. Exactly. Could have been here. We could have celebrated. Pie. Oh, well. But next obstacle, good to be plotting out. You know, we've talked about that before, some of the hazards of being a Black educator, but glad to hear that we talked about that a lot in workplace racism, difficulties with those exams, and that is another manifestation of white supremacy racism, how they make it difficult for Black people to get those certifications and qualifications needed to advance your career. Deliberately difficult. That is not, when we talked about it, that is not unconscious bias. Let's see. Much obliged. Congratulations again, sir, and hopefully we'll get to see you at the retreat soon. Self-care, super important. Glad to hear you're doing great things. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, star 61, number is 720-716-7300, star 61 to participate. And folks, if were folks going to answer, respond to B's question about if you have a code for your safety, personal safety, economic safety, given the massive chaos and unemployment and loss of wages and all that. Do folks want to respond to her question or have other comments, especially if we missed you totally? Well, folks are getting their thoughts together again. Vegan banana pudding, so do not wait till the last second, especially if you wanted to get a response into B's question. I thought that was super, super important. Let's see. The white dog. I'm so sad. I was so bummed that we missed out on being able to have our discussion on White Dog this week, because I've said consistently I think that book is so important. What does it mean to be classified as white? We will be resuming this Thursday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We discussed it a bunch at the retreat here. But yeah, we will be back to normal. I know folks were messaging. I did get Thomas in New York. I did get his email about Colin Kaepernick and the incident with the chomping, with the person wearing the Kaepernick jersey. Timing. Lots of folks, I think, saw that one, timing. But yeah, we'll be back with the book club this coming Thursday. Looking forward to continuing. I was flipping ahead because I was thinking like, oh, we could at least do the book club. But yeah, we were cooking, yoga at the retreat. But we will be back this week. I flipped ahead and he continues with his rants against Stokely Carmichael. So we will be continue to be right where we should be with reading this textbook, Romaine Gary, White Dog. In fact, we even we missed a page during last week's segment, but I was able to go back and include it in the archive, and I was able to update the PDF of the book, so it's accurate. No longer missing a page. And it was an important page, too. He mentioned Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which is also in my top 10. Like, wow, how could I miss that page? But even that has been corrected. I'll put the refreshed link in the description so folks can make sure they have the total copy of the book. No missing pages. I'll refresh the link. Let's see. Other folks, comments, especially if we miss you totally. Other folks, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, or anyone who wanted to answer B's question about your code for personal safety.
Hello. Can I add to that?
Irie in Louisiana? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, for personal safety... Really, it's a matter of not going out as much as possible because I've had a series of interactions on my own incidents that could have led to bad things while I work, outside. So it's basically staying in as much as possible. And when I'm not working, is practicing, good hygiene, and I take a lot of supplements, and my son takes a lot of supplements. I feel like that would help people, too, learning about what boosts the immune system, not in a reactionary way, but in a, I guess you could say, like a cumulative way, like taking vitamin C and, all kinds of other stuff. Colloidal silver, and for me, personal safety is also, like, every now and then I just try to make sure I stay abreast of what's going on in the area where I live without getting too engrossed into sensationalized news and everything, but just to know, okay, it might not be a good day for me to go out and work tonight if something's happening, so I think staying on top of what's going on in your local area. And I want to add, I'm not getting a vaccine. I don't want my son to get a vaccine, Thomas, but I'm also aware that there might be some ramifications for that, and I'm not sure how to prepare, but I don't want a vaccine, and I don't want my son to have it. And the lady that said that water, eating things with water is integral. I wanted to advocate again, maybe the book, You're Not Sick, You're Thirsty, might be good to go over because you can't just drink water. You have to eat it. You have to eat it, and you also have to eat your nutrients. And a lot of them are only bioavailable when you eat those water, those water heavy, plants and fruits. And that was all.
Much obliged, Irie, answering Thomas's question about the vaccine. I've seen a number of reports where medical officials have said that they do not think that there's going to be a vaccine before the end of this calendar year, 2020. And I mean, just it's August. It's not even the first week of August anymore. So what do we think this is going to be here? September? October? I mean, it's short. The year is almost over, basically. The Rona has consumed a lot of this year already. So, I mean, we got a really short amount of time for this to be something that's going to come this year. And there have been a number of, just this week, just since we got in D.C., that have said, nope, not going to happen this year. We shall see. Let's see. Other folks, if we missed you totally, again, do not wait till the last minute. If we have folks who want to respond to the vaccine question, I forgot, Thomas in New York asked, and or be in Toronto's question about what type of code you have for your safe economic safety, personal safety, all of the above. Moving forward, folks have commentary. Proceed.
Hey, I did have commentary to make. One is they released the tape of George Floyd from the police camera after all these months and all this destruction. And, man, you talk about having a code. You have to have a code when we deal with police, fighting back, trying to not get in the car. What can you say? Either way, as far as the economic thing, you know, to me, this was very difficult for black people because black people generally are the most unemployed, they're underemployed, and generally live check to check. And just like this, 55 million Americans have lost their jobs since March. So I would say a huge amount of that is black people. You know, even if 4 million was black people, that's 10% of our population. There's only 40 million people. So it's a huge burden for black people to be able to plan for economic hardship because we generally live check to check. You know, we kind of make things happen as they go. And this one in particular, because it came out of the blue, it came up so quickly. On people, all of a sudden one day you're at work and you hear, hey, don't come back tomorrow. And then a lot of people lost their jobs. I was fortunate enough not to and have a company, you know, that was able to just pay me while I sat at home. But most people didn't. And I'm seeing in the streets so many people hanging out that normally would have been at work doing things that to make money that they probably shouldn't. Today, Trump cut the benefits that people would get from $600 a week to $400 a week. I think the number one people affected by this, that the people that are the most vulnerable when it comes down to Area 1 economics is black people. You know, we're bearing the brunt of this whole thing. And for the most part, you're looking at something that has killed 0.04% of the population of the United States. So on top of you losing everything, it's like, man, I mean, you know, we're losing it for what? You know, so this is a difficult time, and I think things are just going to get worse because the jobless economy that I've been talking about for years, this is it. This is the introduction. Most of this stuff is being done by fintech, automation, you know, and those jobs are never coming back. Unfortunately, we're going to be at the bottom of the, you know, whatever goes down as a result of all this, and we never get the high end of anything. So to me, that's the key thing that I take as far as economics is most black people, more than a few, can't plan for an economic event like this. Can't plan for losing their job and how I'm going to pay my bills. And it's the fact that homelessness, glad he put a moratorium on eviction, but that was about to be the next thing to really go big here in New York. And that was mostly going to be black people affected. They haven't paid rent in months. And according to the landlord, they owe for that back rent, even though, you know, so this is a bad time for us. I mean,
when would that not be true under the system of white supremacy? But yes, very bad times. Let's see. Other folks who doubt if you had either answer to B's question about your code preparation and or the vaccine question, feel free. I could say black people, even at times where they were like public having like picnic lynchings of black people, like bring banana pudding and come watch a Negro be killed. Bring the white dog too. That even then black people, you know, did from the meager effort that they could to try to prepare and stave off things, like they had insurance associations and that sort of thing. So even from pretty meager stakes, like black people have done some amazing things that are constructive, and you'd be surprised once you get people thinking in that direction. I think that's key. thinking in that direction, thinking that way ahead of time. That's why I think Mr. Fuller, way in advance of the Rona, was saying things like, develop a savings habit, be about essentials. Sabrina Johnson talked about that today, that this is going to force a lot of people to be about essentials and not wasting time and energy, not wasting period, not wasting anything, which is something we should have been doing the entire time. We're under the system of racism, white supremacy, particularly because racists can make this sort of thing happen when they feel like it. So, yeah, good habit to be in. Other folks, comments, questions, they wanted to make sure they get, again, not waiting until the last minute. Man, it is, whew, being on the East Coast and doing the compensatory call-in is always a massively different experience. But anyway, other folks, if you have commentary, questions, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes. Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes. From my studies, white people collectively have always had I guess the word would be a cryptid-like history on, you know, having, I mean, goes far back as Halloween and pillaging and running up and down the streets, you know, from where they reside at, just killing each other or something like that. That's you know, definitely has been in their history. So I'm not really surprised. I've heard of hurricane parties, being that I'm a lifetime resident of South Florida. I've heard of hurricane parties all my life. And it was always associated with white people. And the white people who reported the news, would make fun of it. You know, it passes the time of day for such an event as a hurricane, you know, and they actually, you know, report on it and that sort of thing, and white people refusing to leave an area that is, you know, seriously in the path, you know, right up on the shores or something like that, and they're out on the porch with their legs up in the air, crossed and whatnot, observing things going on, including tornadoes. I've never heard of tornado party, but I've seen them actually for fun chasing storms, chasing tornadoes, and you can see that on YouTube on a constant basis. That sort of thing. It almost seems like they're only a few feet away from them. That sort of thing. Yeah. There's another thing I also wanted to report is also one of my siblings, the youngest to be exact, she informed her nephew, my offspring, about an effort that a black male, he is formerly was the director of the City of Miami Fire Department years ago. I think now he is presently the vice mayor of Miami-Dade County. He developed a couple of years ago an initiative that is available for quote-unquote what the term, the popular term that is called at-risk young people to be able to go into, and it would make them quote unquote employable for the fire service. And so the challenge is for, you know, with this pandemic going on, everything is not, things are not straightforward like you normally understand it as such to be able to get information back that you're supposed to complete. He has to complete and turn in this application, ACT, SAT scores, proof of a high school diploma, proof of a Florida's driver's license to get started with that. So that's the excitement for the week. I am going to make sure that he gets all of those things in by Wednesday. and we'll see what happens. No one would be more happier than the retired firefighter if he gets invited to this this particular effort. There was a similar situation that he attempted a few years ago, and I recall my offspring telling me that it was a white person in the interview session that saw his name and said, and I quote, "Your name sounds familiar." But I would say that problem would not probably would not come up this time because this is another fire department. This is not Miami-Dade County Fire Department. This is the city of Miami's fire department. And so I don't think that problem would come up like the other one did. Anyway, that's it. Thank you.
Well, I won't say congratulations, but that is that at least sounds
not
like
yet.
A very promising start. We'll at least say that and send out lots of well wishes and folks do some prayers, all that, send some good energy. That is, yeah, excellent start. Retired firefighter taking advantage of the legacy situation. See there? You, I got you, son. Just tell them the last name and we got, see there? That's how the Bushes and all of the Clintons, they do. You just go in and give them the last name. Just go in and tell a firefighter, and that's your last name. There you go. Context of white supremacy, but that is spectacular. And, man, the report on the firefighters when the white author was talking about the Klansman and his family, and he said that the racists, the Klans members, went and joined the fire department. I said, oh, man. That explains a whole lot. That's why they got the gorilla masks at all the fire departments and putting the penis in. That's why we got to hear this every week. They called such and such a nigger and brought watermelons in to everybody. The Klansmen, they just got upset and went and, okay, we'll just get on the fire truck and mistreat the niggers that way.
That reminds me, Gus, I have another short story that's on that subject. Can I share it?
Let's hear it.
When I was the last station that I retired, when I retired, I was working at this station. White male, he was a driver from Louisiana, was reportedly, it's supposed to have been an expert cook. Expert cook. That alone gave me the premise to never eat none of his food. His behavior, his attitude and behavior was he devolved a lot of trashy conversation, what white people would call jokes. And I purposely would never change my face, my facial expression, you know, of anything as though I would just give a stareful look and that's it and wouldn't respond to it one way or the other. Or anything he would have to say. That and not eating his food. So eventually, one shift, we had to change out the truck. And the other two guys, both black males, they went off somewhere. And it was only myself and this guy who was just standing around the truck and whatnot. And I can feel him about to, did I mention he was a minister also? I'm not sure, but he was a minister also, reportedly. So I can feel him about to ask me some sort of question. So I was kind of like getting ready for it, you know, whatever it was. And he asked me the traditional question that the religion of Christianity, a person ask another person about whether or not if you die today on what would happen to you, what do you think would happen to you, that sort of thing like that. And I said, let me tell you something. If whatever you believe in as a religion, if you take it to white people and it solves the problem immediately,
of racism, white supremacy, and I'm aware of it, then you come to me with that. And he never said another word to me for the rest of the time that he was on the fire department, and we worked in the same station on the same shift until he retired. And that was about for about a whole year or something like that before he retired. But yeah, that was I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a minister also and so-called an expert cook. But that's it. Thank you. I still laugh about that.
Wouldn't have been funny if you had ate a few of his meals. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade. We give that recommendation out on workplace racism. I know I've said it dozens of times just this year alone. We're not going on the job to eat. You get a paycheck. You should have groceries. Not going there. I'm not a dog. Biscuits? Oh, yes. No. Nope. I'm good. Thank you. World Renegade. Yeah, I'm good. Workplace racism. Folks, we missed hope. We have, it is almost time for banana pudding. Any folks we missed totally, or have other folks who had final comments they wanted to get in? We have about 7 minutes before we conclude.
May I be heard?
Be in Toronto.
Hi, thanks, Gus. Yes, in terms of answering Thomason's in New York's question regarding the vaccination, I will not be taking the vaccination, also my son will not be taking the vaccination. At this time, we don't even take the flu vaccination. And the reason being that, number one, there's not enough time elapsed to determine how successful it is. Number two, it would require some components of the virus, which is concerning, that we would not want to contract, even though they might say that it will boost the immune system. Again, not enough data has reflected this. And then also just from where it's coming from and who's designing it. It could be just another way to mistreat non-white people, and particularly black people. I remember Tuskegee with the syphilis situation, medical apartheid. So those are my concerns around there. So that's why we would not be taking it. Going back to the earlier question that I've mentioned, so some of the safety plans that I was looking into was finding out more information as to what type of mace or pepper spray that I can legally carry. I know that with the increase of white aggression, although one may walk away, what I've observed in past is that whites will tend to then begin stalking as well. If they were to physically aggress, then at least to have that device available to give enough time for myself to get away. I would also see about getting one for my son as well. I would urge you and callers and listeners, everyone, to consider finding out what devices are legal to carry. I know in Toronto, we're not allowed, well, in Canada, depending on which area, we're not allowed to carry guns, or I definitely would have registered for a firearm unless you're in certain regions within Canada. But to find out about the devices such as pepper spray and mace, and that there's certain legal forms that you can only carry. I'm not quite sure about the tasers. I'll find out if we're legally allowed to carry tasers or not, and if so, what kind, as well as taking up self-defenses classes as well. Thanks, and I'll leave the line.
Great ideas. Oh, is that?
Hello?
Irie, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, ma'am.
I want to add this before time's up, and I'll expound on it next time, next Saturday if I have to, because I know time is short. Something as far as a financial safety measure, I would advocate people to diversify their money into precious metals. And I, like I said, if I can call in next Saturday, I'll explain my method. But it's really not expensive, and it's not as hard as people think. Just, you know, even if you just, every time you get paid by an ounce of silver, doesn't have to be special, and you can get gold in less than ounces. You can get them in grams. And then there's other types of coins you can go for if you want to get some added value. But I would diversify into silver and gold as a backup. Not saying that it's going to necessarily, you know, anything can happen in the system because they make the rules and break the rules as they go. But I've been doing this for years. And because of that, I kind of feel a little bit better knowing that if paper money goes out the window, I have a couple of other things I can do as a mean of exchange, you know, versus bartering or using my body, you know, of i.e. work in exchange for something, hopefully. Thank you. And good night, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Feel like I just heard that. Investing in silver. Do we have last person comment they wanted to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Banana pudding. Everyone satisfied? That's great, too.
Just one investment that I'm looking at. It's a few, but it seems pretty solid, very cheap. It's called XRP. And I'll mute my line. I think it's an altcoin or a cryptocurrency.
Oh, okay. Right on. Right on. Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. That will be a broadcast for this Saturday, August 8th. Wow. That's what I mean, 2020. Like, August is almost half over. Like, anywho, we will be back. Oh, Michael Hickson. We played that report on individuals with disabilities not getting help from COVID-19. That was a black male who died. Quadriplegic, the one they were talking about, said he had no quality of life. Bernelia Randall was a guest on this program. She's been a guest on multiple times, but she was a guest specifically this year in April. We talked about COVID-19. She wrote the book Dying While Black, and she said, according to the health metrics in the system of white supremacy, they already have a chart. When they start talking about who's going to get access and they start talking about triage care, the person who has the lowest quality of life, according to the charts, they already got it calculated, black males. That was first thing that came to mind when I heard that report. Like, we've already got this calculated scientifically. When we say quality of life, yep, Negro males, low quality, yep. Get him on out of here. Then, Dr. Curry, we talked about that. Disability with racism. You're not seen as, oh man, he's disabled. And Americans with disability. Didn't we just have that month, right? They talked all about that. Wow, all the strides that they made. We got to make sure we have ramps and think about their needs. Not for, you're just a Negro in a wheelchair. Anywho, Negro, we heard that. We watched so many documentaries. We heard a white woman, Negro. You aren't going to see any dark Negroes around here. Got to make that one a sound clip. Anywho, White Dog will be back this coming Thursday, back the correct side of the world. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We saw a lot of intoxicated whites outside the ball game. They weren't allowing fans in the stadium, but wow. They were still getting their alcohol as they watched the ball game on the monitors. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be, well, try to stay in. That was suggested many times. Minimize going out and such. That way you can reduce. It's a lot of armed race soldiers. Lots of hazards. Lots of good reasons to kind of be in. Hunker down. Stay safe. If you got to go out, I told you, I just went to the grocery store. That was just like 5 days ago. could have been anything out in the parking lot. Be alert. Be looking around. Try not to have like earbuds in, or at least have one out so that you can hear things that are happening around you. Might be audio cues. You'll totally miss them. You got your earbuds in. I would even say if you're out and about, avoid being on the phone too much. If it's a critical call, if you have offspring or whatever, and, you know, got to be a parent, I understand that. But I would not just be chatting away and, what'd you see on Netflix last night? I'm out. I have no idea what could be happening. I got to be paying attention to what's going on around me. That's the way that we should be thinking. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. No name calling. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.